This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Take a stroll down Broadway and you'll see the signs for popular plays like The Phantom of the Opera and The Lion King. These boffo shows have captivated audiences for decades. But you know, back in the 1930s, mainstream musicals also brought politics to the stage. The country was still struggling with the effects of the Great Depression, so playwrights and composers used their skill to entertain audiences even as they critiqued political corruption and corporate greed. In those days, a play had a short life on Broadway, but the music might well live on. Tim Carter's a music professor at UNC Chapel Hill. He's giving a lecture called Let 'em Eat Cake, Musical Theater in the 1930s America. It's on April 7th at the National Humanities Center in Durham. But right now, Tim Carter is with us on The State of Things. Welcome, Tim. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Frank.
What was the motivation for playwrights like? I mean, set the scene for us, Broadway in the 1930s.
I think there are a couple of things going on there. One is obviously the Great Depression and the way in which one might respond to those quite severe economic and other issues. The other problem is the talking movies. The Jazz Singer comes out in 1929, and Broadway kind of freaks out at that point. It's actually very difficult for Broadway to compete with movies that can do bigger, better shows and distribute them for much less money. It costs much less to go to the cinema than it did to go to the theater in New York in the 1930s.
So that's part of the scene. How did they respond?
They try and create niche markets. It's hard to remember now that New York City was highly divided geographically. We had the Garment District, the Meatpacker District, the Flower District. We've got the Theater District. So within what we call Broadway now, you've got 31 or so theaters working in the 1930s, often side by side. So they each have to develop niche markets. Niche markets that depend on audiences on the one hand and are influenced by the size of the theatre on the other, because that affects ticket income and so on. So you have a large number of theatre owners, producers that are trying to find a space for themselves. And one of those spaces is indeed a kind of political theatre, and very often a musical political theatre, because music was very interesting. In a way, it sanitized things. You could sing things more easily than say them sometimes. So very often, these musical theatre works that deal with politics are much harder hitting in the end than straight plays could be.
And you might get very different opinions. So the New York Times might sniff at some of this working class kinds of theatre, but the working class is loving it, right?
Well, that's another thing that we don't often think about, is how segmented the audiences are in this period. I mean, you've got the tourist trade, just as you have now in New York City. You've got the socialite trade, you know, the well-oiled rich who are going to the theatre quite often. But you have what are very often called white-collar workers. You know, the doctors, the lawyers, the accountants who lived in the New York area and would go to the theatre quite often. And then you've got the a blue-collar trade, as it were, that still goes to certain kinds of theatre. So you have a kind of segmented market, and you have different theatres catering for different parts of the market.
And political discourse in general is far more pointed and far more thoughtful than it is today. There were very serious questions about the direction this nation should take that were part of the popular discourse.
And I think President Roosevelt had a big factor to play in that. The election of FDR in 1932 was a major turning point for this country. The Hoover administration was widely regarded as having been a disaster economically, politically, and in all sorts of other ways. And FDR brought in some ways a ray of light into the country. And he was also quite an enlightened thinker in terms of progressive thought, in terms of ways in which the federal government might help American society rather than hinder it.
One of those ways was to subsidize playwrights, right?
It subsidized playwrights, and through the WPA, you actually had four federally funded arts agencies. You had the Federal Music Project, the Federal Arts Project, the Federal Writers Project, and the Federal Theater Project. So you had four separate agencies, in effect, catering for the arts and providing arts for the nation.
So what kinds of things, and George Gershwin is also somebody who's very active in this theater, this kind of theater at the time, right?
Surprisingly so, in a way. I mean, a lot of people who worked on Broadway were politically towards the left. Indeed, many were card-carrying members of the Communist Party or were fellow travelers in some kind of way. But even those who weren't, people like George Gershwin, were certainly sympathetic to leftist ideas. And that fit in very well with the climate of the first Roosevelt administration, 1932 to 1936, because there were progressive ideas floating around. And the theater folks thought that they could capitalize on that and also play with it in various ways. So Gershwin is very much involved. The title of my lecture, Let Him Eat Cake, comes from the second of the big Gershwin political shows. And the first one was Of the I Sing in 1931.
How obviously and overtly political were they? Did they have to sort of slip it between the lines, or could they sing openly?
No, I think it was absolutely clear to everyone, including the politicians who were in the audience and seemed to enjoy being lampooned. They didn't have much choice in the end. They're sitting there, they're being lampooned, they have to laugh. But FDR himself actually went to see Of the I Sing just before he took up the presidency and reportedly had a great good time watching the federal government being satirized and the whole election process being satirized. There were certain other political figures who chose not to go and see the show because they were being so obviously lampooned in various ways. But I think everyone knew the level of political commentary, and the critics in the newspapers talk about it.
What about, tell us about the play Pins and Needles, and we're going to play a song from there, but tell us more about the play.
Pins and Needles is very interesting. In addition to mainstream Broadway, you have off-Broadway theatres, and you also had in the 1930s a huge number of so-called labor stages, labor theatres, that would put on agitprop productions that usually only lasted two or three nights, and were usually very much making political statements, you know, up the workers, down the capitalists, and so on. And Pins and Needles is a very interesting case. It was supported by the ILGWU, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which was a very progressive trade union for garment workers, but also felt that it had responsibilities to educate and entertain their members. And so they put on this review that was surprisingly successful. They had a first run in 1936, and then from 1937, they basically ran through to 1941. Quite regularly, and even the well-oiled, the rich, would go and see it as kind of slumming it, as it were, because it was full of wonderful, wonderful sketches and wonderful songs that were really making fun of contemporary political situations.
You can't imagine a song with a title like this on Broadway today. This song is called Sing Me a Song with Social Significance.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song.
That's a clip from the tune Sing Me a Song with Social Significance from the 1937 play Pins and Needles. My guest is UNC music professor Tim Carter. He gives a lecture about political musical theater Thursday at the National Humanities Center in Durham. So I guess that also speaks to what outlets you had and where songs of social significance, where people might gather. I mean, today there are many more places in which people talk about things that matter to them. But here, theater may have been one of the few places, public spaces, I guess, where people could talk about theater.
Although what's surprising is the way in which the discourse stretched out from the theaters. You very often find preachers in New York City taking themes from current shows as a basis for their sermons on a Sunday. And so on. And you get this reported in the New York Times. So there's a kind of spreading out as the newspapers report on these shows, as churches engage with the social content of these shows. And so the messages get out there in various ways. But theater is certainly part of that whole mechanism, and it works in a very exciting and a very profound way.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear about the way they spread. I mean, this whole idea that they make their way into sermons and then become part of, you know, then the press is talking about the fact that people are sermonizing.
And of course, the theater producers love this because it means basically that the news of their shows is getting out and about, and everyone wants to go and see these shows in various ways. You know, so they spread the news through the newspapers in different ways. You get different levels of newspapers that engage with different kinds of shows. And at that point, you get more tickets sold, the audiences come in, and it starts feeding one off the other. You get social clubs, you get unions going to the theatre, and so on. So there's a way in which the theatre is a kind of focal point and also a way of distributing all sorts of interesting ideas.
You made mention of a play called Of the Icing a couple of minutes ago. Tell us more about that play.
Of the Icing is a very interesting one. George Gershwin always worked with his brother Ira Gershwin. And it means that they came up with a series of political shows that they put in the Music Box Theatre. It was a fairly small theatre on 44th Street. They only had about 1,000 seats, so it was right for a very intimate kind of political satire. The first one was Strike Up the Band, which wasn't too successful, but Of the Icing was hugely successful, premiered on Boxing Day, 26th of December 1931. And so it tied into the upcoming election season. Everyone knew that the elections were coming up. And it's a wonderful, wonderful satire on the process of the election as John P. Wintergreen, a would-be Democratic president, tries to come up with an election platform that will enable him to succeed to become the president. And what he decides in the end, that the best campaign slogan he can come up with is "Love is sweeping the country." And this fires up the imagination of the Democratic Party. But then, of course, they have to find someone for John P. Wintergreen to fall in love with. And they try to match him up with a kind of a belle from Louisiana, but in the end he falls for Mary from Ohio, who makes good corn muffins. So the whole thing becomes a kind of sentimental right. comedy. And the sidekick is Vice President, or would-be Vice President Throttlebottom, played by Vincent Moore, a wonderful actor, both on stage and screen, who spends the whole show wandering around trying to work out what his political function might be. And everyone says there is no political function for the Vice President.
So there's this undercurrent of cynicism. And this backroom machinations that are using these emotional levers.
And the show brings in the Supreme Court, it brings in the Senate, and basically the hit song, Love is Sweeping the Country, just keeps coming back over and over again.
Well, let's hear it in the Broadway version that we might have heard, or a version of it, that might have sounded in 1931.
Love is sweeping the country, waves are hugging the shore. The sexes from Maine to Texas have never known such love before. See them billing and cooing like the birdies above. Each girl and boy alike sharing joy alike feels that passion'll soon be national. Love is sweeping the country. There never was so much love.
That's a clip of the song Love is Sweeping the Country from the 1931 play of The Icing. My guest is UNC music professor Tim Carter, who's going to give a lecture about political musical theater Thursday at the National Humanities Center in Durham. Now, we would have seen in context, we would have heard the irony in that song to some extent.
There's no question about it. I mean, this is all part of the Democratic Party convention, as it were, to appoint John P. Wintergreen as the Democratic candidate for the presidency. And so there's a lot of satire that's fairly obvious. There's also a boxing match going on at the same time because that's the way they're fighting it out in this kind of fake boxing match and so on. So, yes, satire, irony, political undercurrents would have been absolutely clear.
And yet, as you say, these songs, even though the play might have closed eventually, the songs live on. Sheet music was a very important industry. People were playing these songs.
No, absolutely. Sheet music was important. And also, I mean, these shows were very topical, so they couldn't last very long on the stage. Of the Icing lasted just over a year, which was pretty good for Broadway. But inevitably, these shows were going to go out of date. And revivals were not that common because you needed to be updating right. things and keeping current with what was going on. So the songs had ended up having a separate life through sheet music, through the radio, through a recording industry. And of course, the Gershwins made quite a lot of money from those spin-offs to the shows. They weren't just thinking about writing songs to put in shows, but they were also thinking about writing songs that would develop a currency. And those currencies change over time. It's very rare now that we know the context of most of these great 1930s songs. Cole Porter's It's Still Lovely, you know, we don't know the original show in which that was sung, and we know it as a wonderful song. Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, they write these fabulous songs that stand on their own in all sorts of ways and get changed over time to start to mean something quite different from where they originally were.
Well, I think that's evident then, and as you point out in your talk, and we have evidence of here today, a clip of Ella Fitzgerald singing that very song, Love is Sweeping the Country, but this is decades later, and it has a different valence out of context. Let's listen.
Love is sweeping the country. Waves are hugging the shore. All the sexes
from Maine to Texas have never known such love before.
This is a much more sentimental sounding song, and particularly if you didn't see it in context, right?
I think that's right. I mean, it's wonderful. Ella Fitzgerald recorded in 1959 with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. And it's a performance that really does reflect the American melting pot at that time. You have an African-American singer, the First Lady of Song, as she was known, singing a song by a Jewish composer, George Gershwin, with an orchestration by Nelson Riddle from Orondale, New Jersey. So it's a very interesting mix of types there. Nelson Riddle sentimentalizes the song in his orchestration, and Ella Fitzgerald's slow kind of ballad-like approach turns it into much more of a feel-good number that seems much more characteristic of the 1950s than it does of the 1930s.
What do you make of this, and how relevant is this today? I mean, you're talking about music and politics in theater in the 1930s. It seems to me that are we getting closer to this today? I mean, some of the more bedrock kind of things that people were talking about in the 30s, we're talking about again, finally, because for decades we really hadn't.
I think it's always been there. The 1930s certainly were an exciting, almost left-wing decade. The 1940s, 1950s changed significantly, first because of World War II and then because of the Cold War. By the time you got into the mid-1960s, you start getting this political satire coming back. Cabaret, 1965, is a very good example of a musical that's trying to kind of capture a political theme and critique contemporary society. Hair of 1968, 69. And it comes through into shows like Rent or Urinetown, the musical. You can do a quite interesting chart of Broadway musicals alongside presidential administrations in the US in terms of right and left, in terms of what the themes of the day might be, whether it's AIDS or whether it's poverty or social justice or whatever. So there is an undercurrent of political theater that keeps coming back, certainly from the 1960s on. And we still see it to some extent today as a kind of counterbalance to the much more sanitized version of Broadway that you get in the Lloyd Webber musicals or The Lion King or something like that, or Wicked, which are catering for a very different kind of market.
My guest is Tim Carter. He's a music professor at UNC Chapel Hill. He's giving a lecture called Let 'em Eat Cake, Politics and Musical Theater in the 1930s America. It's April 7th, 6 o'clock at the National Humanities Center in Durham. Tim, thanks for being on the show with
us. Thank you so much for having me.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton-Ormond, and Robin Copley's our technical director. Brett Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.